Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCRIT We. After the podcast 169 with Mervyn Singer, Cliff Deutschman, the co-author of the overview paper on sepsis 3.0, sent me an email saying he had additional thoughts he wanted to add. He didn't want Mervyn to get all the spotlight. He wanted to come on the show. And I said, of course. So Cliff Deutschman is an anesthesiologist and critical care doctor. He has had numerous awards, countless publications, past presidents, Society of Critical Care Medicine, all sorts of the stuff you'd expect on someone who is doing work at this level. I have about a 25-minute conversation with Cliff. I think it definitely adds to the mix, so I hope you enjoy it. Let's get right to it.
The main reason I wanted to do this is that, first of all, we've got a push for the mustaches. And second of all, you know, I don't want people out there thinking that Mervyn is the only sex symbol around.
Damn straight.
So, yeah. Okay. So there have been all kinds of terrific comments about the papers, all three of them. Most of them have been directed to Mervyn and I as the co-authors of the overview paper. And there really are a lot of legitimate concerns that, you know, some of which we can address easily, some of which other people are going to have to help us with. But I think where it all stems from is a need for clarity on what it is we did, because we really did two different things. One of which was for a group of us to sit around and look at what we know about the biology or pathobiology, if you will, of sepsis, and try to come up with a definition. And the second was to come up with some clinical criteria that are actually useful to the practitioner at the bedside. And the place where this starts is looking at what is actually meant by a definition. You know, when you look in the dictionary, what you see is a definition tells you the essence of something. It tells you what something is. And there's absolutely no way we can do that for sepsis. I don't think we really know what it is. We have some sense of what the underlying abnormalities look like, but you can't say with any certainty, you know, this is sepsis. And that led us to come up with a definition, which is life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. There are all kinds of holes in that. What's organ dysfunction? What's a regulated host response, never mind a dysregulated one? So that creates a problem for the person at the bedside. And again, to sort of put that in context, it becomes important when you're looking for any way to define things. So for example, if you've got somebody who's had an MI or a stroke, you can be pretty definitive about that. I mean, we know that you could biopsy tissue and show that there's infarcted tissue. There's no way you can, and then you can correlate that with an X-ray or a lab test or a biopsy or whatever and say, you know, aha, this is an MI. Well, you can't do that with sepsis. You can't say, aha, this patient has sepsis when you throw up an X-ray or look at a lab test or whatever. And that makes the whole clinical problem really difficult. We can look for the things that we want to look at to try and identify patients as early as possible, but we're never 100% sure. And again, context, if you had a patient in an ICU who has a documented infection, positive cultures, and the patient is on a ventilator and getting pressors and requiring renal replacement therapy, we'd all feel pretty comfortable saying, you know, this is sepsis. We wouldn't be 100% sure because we don't have that X-ray or that test or that picture or that biopsy or anything, but we'd be pretty confident. But then what happens when you're down in the emergency room and you've got a patient who you think is infected and who looks pretty sick to you and you're worried, but you can't say with 100% certainty, or even with, you know, any kind of percent certainty at this point? What do you do? And the best thing you can do is start looking for things that would point you towards sepsis, and you can try and justify looking at those things on the basis of some outcome variable that's a proxy, that's a surrogate for sepsis. Now, you can choose any surrogate you want, there are lots of epidemiological approaches to choosing surrogates. The one that Chris Seymour and the people at Pittsburgh chose was to basically talk about an outcome variable, a variable that has outcome validity. So again, if somebody has an infection and they die or they spend a long period of time in the ICU, well, that's an outcome that's pretty consistent with what we think sepsis is. Not 100%, but it's pretty consistent. So that was the outcome variable they chose in looking at clinical criteria. So again, to get back to the beginning, the reason it's so important to separate definitions from clinical criteria is that we don't have that hard, definitive gold standard, if you will. We need some other kind of outcome to use as a proxy, and then we can start looking for the things that will tip off people working in emergency rooms or people working on the wards or even people working in ICUs that a patient who doesn't look so great and who probably has an infection is someone you really need to be concerned about. So again, that's sort of, you know, the big thing there. Now, are there better proxies? Maybe. You know, these were the ones that Chris chose based on previous experience, and they seem to work pretty well. But for example, these are proxies that won't work in children, where the mortality from sepsis is much lower than it is in adults. So using death as an endpoint is probably not going to be all that helpful. We're going to have to find something else. It may not hold up in different patient populations. It may not be an appropriate proxy for under-resourced or resource-limited areas. It may not apply to infections like malaria, where the outcome that you're looking for is maybe something different altogether. So it's just not clear, and there's lots more testing that needs to be done.
Cliff, let me break in and ask about one proxy that I asked Merv about, and I'm still not completely satisfied. And Merv and I had discussed lactate, and Merv had presented a number of reasons why a lactate between 2 and 4 didn't add anything to the out-of-ICU screening, the quick SOFA, and that made sense. But what wasn't really addressed, I think, in the paper or in our discussion was a patient with a lactate of 5, a lactate greater than or equal to 4, we know that's not sensitive. But once that's there, the specificity for patients who will do badly with sepsis or infection, I felt was pretty robust, and that wasn't really addressed. Could you speak to that just for a couple of minutes?
Sure. I mean, I think a lactate of 5 is something that you would think would identify patients who died or patients who spent a long period of time in the ICU. That may well be true. The best thing I can say about that is, you know, the data that were available to Chris to do the analysis didn't validate using lactate. Now, he specifically started at 2, and then he looked at 2, and then 3, and then 4. He never got to 5. Maybe 5 is the threshold that does identify it. But when you use the 3 elements of QSOFA by themselves, you identify, you know, say 85% of the patients who went on to this bad outcome. When you add lactate to those 3 elements, it doesn't change a lot. It changes a little, but it doesn't change a lot. And you're sort of balancing 2 things when you do that. On the one hand, you're balancing the predictive value. So say adding lactate to QSOFA takes you from identifying 85% of the patients to identifying 88% of the patients. Well, that's 3% of patients that you could identify, and that's a good thing. The flip side of it is, though, that to get the lactate requires a lab test. It requires a lab that's capable of it, and that doesn't work everywhere. So, for example, we had people saying to us, you know, lactate is really valuable. You want that 3%, and I'm making up that number. So we should make everybody measure lactates. The flip side of it is we had people in South America and India telling us that they can't routinely measure lactate, and if we mandate it for something, they're not going to be able to ever use the criteria. So we sort of traded off that 3%, you know, the added sensitivity, if you will, for ease of use, for feasibility, if you will. Now, again, the flip side of it is, suppose you've got somebody who has no Q-sulfa criteria or one Q-sulfa criteria, but you think they're infected and you've sent off cultures and started antibiotics and they just don't look good. They don't meet those criteria. You can't calculate the score and say, aha, they are Q-sulfa positive, but something's bothering you. So you send off a lactate and it comes back as 5. Well, I think most reasonable people would agree that that's a patient you ought to be really concerned about. And, you know, how you choose to approach that is going to vary from place to place and from maybe from practitioner to practitioner. But I think it would, you know, set off a bell ringing in the back of just about everybody's head. That's the best we can say about it in the patient populations that we identified. Now, again, the flip side of it is there are lots of other patient populations. There are lots of other places that this ought to be looked at. And, you know, maybe as we expand the data set, as we include more and more patients and more areas and more regions and whatever, we'll find that, you know, the lactate of 4 or 5 really is a useful test. And it's so useful that we can't say that that the feasibility issue, that we can't discount it on the basis of it's too hard to do. And we're going to have to include it because it's so valuable to making the to identifying patients. But we don't know the answer to that yet, and we're just going to have to wait and see what happens. And hopefully, everybody from here on in will be collecting data and looking at these things and, you know, checking us. Is it right? Is it wrong? Can we do better? How do we do better? Are there other variables to look at? Which ones? Where else should this be applied? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the single, you know, one really important thing out of this is we can't wait another 14 years to go from sepsis 3 to sepsis 4. It's got to happen faster than that.
And, absolutely.
And that means we want everybody participating as any way possible. Now, it may well be that some society or group or institution will need to set up a repository to make this possible. That, again, is something to think about, but it's absolutely something we've encouraged everybody to do.
Great answer, Cliff. Why don't we go further with the things you had on your list?
Okay. Now you're going to make me look. So one of the other concerns that was raised that sort of fits in with what we just talked about is the applicability of Q-SOFA or what I'll call Delta SOFA, which is the change in the regular SOFA score of 2 or more in smaller hospitals, if you will. Again, this is absolutely legitimate. The great majority of hospitals in this country and elsewhere are smaller, are 200 or less beds. A lot of places where septic patients are likely to be seen are going to be clinics that aren't hospitals at all. Do these measures work there? Well, the best we can say about that is that we looked, we did our derivations. The initial derivative set was done at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, their health system, which is 23 hospitals, more than half of which are less than 200 beds, and 2 of which are actually under 100 beds. So there are data embedded in that particular data set that represent those hospitals. And then there's Kaiser Permanente, which is even bigger and has a huge number of hospitals with under 200 beds. So somewhere within those data set, the data sets that we used, there's probably an answer to the question. My guess would be that knowing Chris Seymour as I know him and knowing he's an ambitious guy, that's probably something he's teasing out even as we speak. And if there is an answer within those data sets, I think we can expect to see it relatively soon. Another concern that was raised is whether or not QSOFA works in under-resourced areas. And I always find it interesting that they talk about under-resourced areas as being, in South America or Africa or whatever, and we tend to forget that there are under-resourced areas in the United States too, which we don't like going up to, but it's absolutely true. And the answer to that is, again, we don't know. Those are studies that need to be done. Now, one of the things I would encourage is that there are people out there who do have data sets from those under-resourced areas. For example, there was a paper in a Brazilian journal by Ranzini that looked at a fairly large data set of septic patients across Latin America, I think primarily in Brazil. That data set is owned by the Latin American Sepsis Institute, LASI, and it certainly could be looked at to see if QSELFA works there. That would be really important data, and it would be useful to know. So that's sort of two of my biggest concerns.
What else could you tell us about SOFA and QSELFA?
Yeah, the one other thing I'll raise actually is the whole issue of septic shock, which I find it fascinating that this is the thing. You said this yourself, that you were really comfortable with this. You really liked this, was my take from your conversation.
Yeah, I thought this was a huge step forward to getting hospitals and countries comparing the same patients to each other for mortality.
So what's really interesting about this is the discussions that we had when we were moving into the definitions and clinical criteria for septic shock was, why do we need septic shock? Why do we need to separate it out from sepsis alone? What's the importance? What's the value? And you could start with, what is septic shock? There were people who had been involved with the original definitions who said, well, it's sepsis where the organ dysfunction is cardiovascular dysfunction. Some of us were, a bunch of people were uncomfortable with that because at this point in time, it's reasonable to think that shock is a cellular phenomenon, maybe even a subcellular phenomenon, that it involves something more than simply a single system not working. And the definition contains that. It says that it's cardiovascular dysfunction and metabolic, cellular or metabolic abnormalities. So we sort of tried to include both of that in the definition. But when it came to looking for clinical criteria and to fleshing out that definition, what is it that makes septic shock different from sepsis? And why is it important? Do we treat it differently? Well, no. You're still going to give antibiotics. You're still going to give fluids. You're still going to do the same support system, same support and interventions that you would do if the patient didn't have quote unquote septic shock. Is there something really different about the underlying abnormality, the underlying biology or pathobiology? Maybe, but we don't know because we don't know enough about those things. So ultimately, what it comes down to is the real reasons for knowing the difference, and I think your comment hits on this really well, are epidemiologic or prognostic. It's important to have something that we can count. It's important to be able to tell people something. And the main distinguishing characteristic that separates septic shock from sepsis is these are patients who do really badly or who are really, really sick as opposed to just sick. And that's built into the definition and built into the clinical criteria. The definition says this is a group of septic patients with cardiovascular and cellular / metabolic abnormalities with a significantly increased mortality when compared to patients with sepsis alone. And we built that into the clinical criteria, which boiled down to looking at things that have been used in the past clinically to characterize septic shock, things like hypotension and the need for vasopressors and the lactate level that we just spoke about, and trying to figure out what combinations actually identified a group of patients whose mortality was tangibly worse than the patients who didn't have them. And the only combination we could come up with that really identified a group of patients in our data sets whose outcome was really bad were the patients who had both pressor-dependent hypotension and a lactate level greater than 2. Now, again, we've gotten some pushback on that, there were people in the room who said, well, no, wait a minute, isn't hypotension alone good enough? Isn't the need for pressors alone good enough? And isn't there this thing called cryptic shock where you have a really high lactate but nothing else overt? And the answer is maybe, but the data we have don't bear that out. One more argument for continuing to collect data, for continuing to look forward, and maybe, you know, when the data set gets bigger and bigger and bigger, we'll find that those really are real entities and that we can tease out an even finer group of patients who do have, you know, as you suggested, a lactate greater than 5, whose mortality is substantially higher than the patients who don't have a lactate higher than 5. But in the data that we looked at, it took all three criteria, hypotension, requirement for pressors, and an elevated lactate, to demonstrate a statistically significant increase in mortality or difference in mortality.
Well, you don't have to sell me on this one. As I've already said, I think this was a step forward. I just want to clarify, when I said the patient had a lactate of 5, I wasn't pretending there's a new threshold. My point was that greater than or equal to 4 wasn't really examined in Chris's data. And that's why I said 5. I'm not talking about a new threshold. I'm talking about our existing threshold of what defined the three big randomized controlled trials we just had, which is treating patients with a lactate greater than or equal to 4. But I think the comments still remain intact, I think. I think the last thing we should talk about, I know we're running short on time, Cliff, but I think it's worth discussing, is there are people out there who have written in, and I'm sure you've gotten similar emails about, why is SIRS gone? Why have you bashed SIRS? For me personally, I think that's also a step forward. I despise the SIRS criteria, I think, for many of the reasons you're going to give, but I think we should address it because people have asked about it. So can you speak about that for a couple minutes?
You know, the first thing I can say is I'm old enough to remember when the SIRS was a huge step forward, when we were incredibly grateful that somebody was putting out something that you could hang your hat on every time, even if there were concerns with it. So the issues with SIRS are a couple. The first is that it's very sensitive. I mean, it identifies almost all the patients that are identified by, you know, QSOFA or Delta SOFA. Unfortunately, it identifies a whole lot of other patients. Example, you know, within the clinical realm where I work, which is surgical critical care, I mean, virtually every post-op patient meets SIRS criteria, almost without fail. Are we to assume that if they have suspected infection, which again, you can suspect infection in every post-op patient, and in fact, you know, the CDC is hammering that should never happen, so we better be suspecting it. You could make a diagnosis of sepsis and everybody rolls out of the operating room using the SIRS criteria and suspected infection. By the same token, you know, anybody with a bad cold is going to meet SIRS criteria. My favorite, you know, qualification on that is a nameless intensivist once said that he got SIRS every time he was alone with his wife. So, I mean, that's how nonspecific it is. How overly sensitive it is. In the data sets that Chris examined, QSOFA and SOFA had sensitivity that was equal to SIRS. Most of the patients identified by SIRS would be identified by one of those two other things. But a whole lot of patients that were identified by SIRS that didn't seem to meet criteria for sepsis weren't identified by QSOFA, weren't identified by the Delta SOFA. So what you're doing is preventing potentially the treatment of a whole lot of patients who don't need treatment. Now, is that important? Well, if you've got a 70-year-old guy with a history of congestive heart failure and you suspect sepsis and you're about to put 3 liters of fluid into him, yeah, that's really important. You really don't want to do that if you don't have to. And that's just an example. Should SIRS disappear altogether? No. SIRS tells you when there's inflammation. SIRS is a good, you know, a good handle on inflammation. And that's important to know about. Can it be used to help you towards a suspicion of infection? Sure. Should you measure it anyway? Should it be one of those things that you keep in the back of your mind when you're really, really concerned about a patient, but you haven't met the Qs, you know, the 2 QSOFA points or the 2 Delta SOFA points yet? Is it one of the things that should make, you know, that little ding go off in the back of your mind? Yeah. It's valuable information. It just doesn't happen to be as specific as these two new measures are for patients who meet the outcome proxies that we used for sepsis.
Perfect. Cliff, finish it up. What's the last message you want to give out to the people about sepsis?
There are two big things. Big thing number one is remember that there's a difference between definitions and clinical criteria. We need to be careful about how we use the words, and we need to be careful about, you know, what we're doing looking forward. And the most important thing I would say moving forward is help us out. Help everybody out. Help every practitioner who has to deal with septic patients. Help people who are doing research. What is organ dysfunction? What is a dysregulated host response? If you notice something in a bunch of patients that you think might be, you know, might be important, yeah, say so. It's one more thing to examine as we move towards making the definition something that might actually be clinically useful as we hone in on what the real definition of sepsis is. And the second thing is, yeah, keep testing this stuff. Look at everything, you know, duplicate what we've done, but do it prospectively. If you've got a database, apply the things that Chris did to that database and see if it holds up. Look at different patient populations. You know, it's up to all of us to keep this thing moving forward so that it doesn't stall for 15 years again. You know, I would be very disappointed if within the next 5 years we didn't change everything all over again. I think that's essential to improving the care of patients. I think it's essential to getting a handle on the biology of this really bad disorder.
Perfect. Just perfect.
Thank you.